Yes, I do, Sister White.
We will not fear.
The kingdom is alive. The kingdom's on the move with the poor and the meek and the hungry and the lonely.
I'll never forget it.
Welcome to Adventist Voices Spectrum's podcast. I'm Alexander Carpenter, and I'm honored to be joined by the editors of a new publication, A House on Fire, How Adventist Faith Responds to Race and Racism. Thank you for joining us today, Mari Jackson and Nathan Brown. How are you doing, Mari?
Doing great, thank you.
And Nathan, coming all the way from Australia, great to have you with us.
Indeed. Thank you for the opportunity.
It's great. And I want to thank you, actually, for your work in creating this book. It's a gift to Adventism. Scholars, pastors, activists, students, everyone in the pew should read this. I kind of think of it, because it's an edited collection of some of our favorite writers here at Spectrum, this is the perfect thing for a Sabbath school class, for like a nice half a year or year study, book club, church book club, I think it would be great for. They're very thoughtful, digestible chapters. So thanks from one editor to two others. Thanks for your work on creating something that really works as a whole.
Thank you.
Yes, it was interesting to work on a project like this and see how they come together and see, you know, even the sequencing and how they fit together. And there does seem, at least as we work through it, there does feel like there's kind of this natural flow through it, and that a number of the pieces build on each other and interact with each other in some really interesting ways. It's like when you're hanging an art exhibition and the way you do that changes, you know, adds extra energy to what would be just an individual piece by itself.
Yeah. Well, you're both living proof that editors and scholars can get along. I thought maybe I'd talk to you first about how this came to be, the birth of the idea, and how you kind of brought it into something that you thought might be a good idea and might work out, actually.
So, Nathan, I've been telling this story. I want you to tell it and see if my memory, if I have false memories, corrected a little.
Indeed. Possibly the pre-conversation to this conversation was some ongoing chats I'd had with Kendra Holoviak-Valentine on the topic of race. And she told me about this guy called Mari Jackson that I really should meet and have a chat to him. But it was not until I saw him on a podcast here, or heard him on a podcast that was on this side of the ocean, hosted by Peter Dixon over here. And Mari, one of the things that really caught my attention was Mari talked about his doctoral studies, which was sort of Adventist publishing and social justice, and how those two things don't or do or should interact. And, of course, they're two things that I have a very strong interest in. So went back to Kendra and said, hey, you know, told me I should talk to Mari. I think this is the time. And this, of course, was in the second half of 2020 and all the things that were going on there. I read Mori's dissertation, and then I made an appointment to have a chat with him. And that conversation went into a lot of the things that were happening in 2020, including the aftermath of George Floyd's murder, the Black Lives Matter protests all over the world. And it had kind of been something in the back of my head that I really thought that we should have an Adventist voice, or a collection of Adventist voices, that was actually saying something meaningful in response to that, and that we had something meaningful to add to that, not just a response for the sake of it, but that we had unique things and value to take it further in some directions. And so that was the beginning of the conversation with Mori. And by late 2020, we'd sent out invitations to the first contributors. And then the project grew over the following couple of years.
Mori, can you just, since your dissertation was mentioned, do you mind just briefly talking about your dissertation and then what drew you to this project?
Sure thing. when I was studying at Claremont, I wanted to, I was in a theology, ethics, and culture program. And come to find out, it's the same program that one of the contributors, Olive Hemmings, was in. She was in the PhD. I was in the Doctor of Ministry, but in the same program. So trying to bring these three disciplines into a conversation with each other. And I just want, the thought came to my mind, 9/11 has happened. We're about 5 years out. How have official Adventist journals address contemporary moral issues in light of the reality that some of the things we thought were simply personal ethics, we recognize now that, you know, if you're in drugs as an addict, you're also contributing to trafficking that is funding a lot of organizations that are involved in incredible social problems. So I just wanted to see how they were treating contemporary moral issues in light of that. And so I basically went and looked at Message Magazine and Ministry Magazine and just did a comprehensive review of the articles that were published. And that helped me to really think we probably should develop a model of moral theological reflection and Adventism that comes through in our journals more richly.
That's helpful. So when Nathan reached out to you with this idea, as you were getting to know each other, why did you say yes to taking on a big project like this?
Well, I'll tell you, first, Nathan, you added some things to this that I didn't know. And so I owe Kendra and Gil I owe them a meal. I didn't know she was doing that, but Kendra and I have had some great conversations. Her office suite is across the hall from mine. And we will trade books and enrich each other. And I'm grateful to her for that. Part of the reason, I guess, I said, yeah, let's do this, is because I've done a lot of writing projects that didn't come to fruition. I mean, I did my part, but the publishers or those who were pulling the projects together didn't get them across the finish line. So I was like, well, why not another one?
Keep hope alive.
Exactly. But it was also during lockdown. And so while we were all locked down, I thought, you know, I don't have much of a commute to work. I just come downstairs to the office. So I thought we probably could be productive. But more so when Nathan had sent me some of his own publications, I realized, wait a minute, there's somebody who's actually doing this in the Adventist community and doing it real well. I'm aware of Spectrum and they do it well. And I'm aware of Adventists Today and they engage and try to raise the bar of discourse in Adventist reflections on contemporary matters and on our heritage. But when I saw that, I said, man, this is the way to go. And so, and then when we met on a Zoom call, it became pretty clear in our conversation that we were of kindred souls. Yeah.
That's cool. Well, since you mentioned publishing, I'll mention that this is a church publication, Signs Publishing out of Australia, which you lead there, Nathan, as their books are fantastic. And that means that this is endorsed by the church. The president of the North American division endorses it on the back, Bill Johnson. And that's great. Ricardo Graham, former president of the Pacific Union out here on the West Coast of California, or including California, endorses it. And at the same time, you've got some nice quotes in here from people like James Baldwin, James Cone, and of course, the prophet Isaiah. Nice list of prophets there. So yeah. I thought that it was great to see this mix of people. And to me, that really it typifies what the kind of intellectual project here is. You're bringing Adventists and their commitment to Scripture in conversation with modern prophets who have been talking about these issues long before a bunch of folks saw what happened to George Floyd and kind of woke up a little bit. So thank you for the educational project and the conversations that you're fostering. Let's just talk about some of the folks that you have as your authors through here. Janice DeWitt, Olive Hemmings, Claudia Allen, Angela Lee, Yishin Ma, Andy Lampkin. Of course, both of you, and I want to talk later about both of your chapters in the book. Matthew Cortman, Kendra Holowiak-Valentine's in here, Mark Carr, Marlene Ferreris, Hans Gutierrez, John Webster. So that's just some of them. I didn't catch all of them in there. But if you wouldn't mind just talking a little bit about what those folks in general bring, and then if there's some ones that you know that just stand out in your mind right now, I'd love to hear your thoughts on some of the concepts that they're bringing to bear on this issue.
Nathan, if I can start this, I want to just say one of the conversations Nathan and I had was who to include. And in that conversation, I don't remember who led and what. I just remember where my commitments were. I think Nathan led to make certain we had a lot of women who were contributors. And I agreed with that. But I think I remember you being the first to say, hey, we got to do this. I was concerned about two things. One was if we were going to talk about an Adventist response to race and racism, and I think at first our initial subtitle was an Adventist approach to anti-racism. One of the things I thought of is, look, then we need contributors who come from the continents of Asia, Africa, North and South America, Australia, Europe, and the islands of the sea. Mm-hmm. And I wanted that to be one of the very first commitments we had so that we reached broad enough. The other commitment I wanted is to have people from union level tertiary institutions. Because I think oftentimes we forget that we have quality, well-educated religion professors educated at the best institutions in the world, and we don't give volume to their voice. And I thought that this is important because they're really addressing these issues in their territories, in their union and institutions. And so those were some of the reasons we chose the persons that we chose. Now, some of them might have been born in a continent, have moved here, or their parents were and migrated, but it was trying our best to draw in the connections we had.
Great. That's a really helpful way of understanding the book, and I love the way that you frame it. Nathan, what was important for you as you were shaping the book and working with these authors?
Yeah, well, you can't talk about a topic like racism without including diversity. That just has to be what you do, because you need those different voices. You need people from all the different parts of those experiences. And, you know, we've got people who grew up in South Africa. We've got people who bring an Asian background and people who come from all different colors and ethnic backgrounds. And that's, I think, one of the things that we're modeling is when you bring a diversity of people together to talk about a topic as important as this, you have a much stronger piece. And Murray and I have reflected that even if the two of us had simply sat down and tried to write this book together, it would have been lesser. You know, it might have been a bit more focused in some ways and a bit tighter perhaps, but it would have lacked something. And so I think that modeling this idea of conversation and the necessity of listening to people from a wide diversity of backgrounds if we are to meaningfully address some of these large and complicated issues in our world. So I think that is a significant thing that the book does. From, I guess, my perspective, as Maury mentioned, we also were conscious of gender diversity, and you know that's a significant thing. I think that too many of our church committees, our church projects are dominated by men, and whether that's white men or other in other situations, you know, who are the leaders. It is one of the default mechanisms of our church system, is because we only ordain men, most of the positions end up being occupied by men. And so we need to be really intentional to try and overcome that lack of diversity in that way.
Yeah.
So that, and even that, you know, I was kind of doing the math on it the whole way through the project, and we had a few chapters come in a bit later, which added significantly to the book, but they all, the, almost all of them came from men, and they upset the balance that we were really looking for.
That's true.
That's just the process of, as we were talking to people, as we were sharing it, there were others that came back and said, hey, I think you need something that talks about this. And in those situations, we often said, well, hey, would you like to write that? And that's where we got to.
Nice.
So, yeah, I think it's been a fascinating process of, you know, we probably would have liked to have done it a bit quicker than we did. 2 years is a long time to be working on a project, but it also gave it that opportunity to grow somewhat organically and take the shape that it finally did.
Yeah. Let's, in your introduction, you do a nice job of talking about a little bit of that shape. You have a kind of cluster of folks that you describe as going from the familiar to the unfamiliar. And then we have some urgent biblical themes to practical considerations, from believing to engaging to acting in the world. Some of those authors are kind of focusing on that. And then two more, from our family of faith to our neighborhoods, kind of helping Adventists get out of the church, out and into the community, and understanding that's an act of anti-racism as well. And then you kind of get into kind of bigger ideas of epistemology and helping Adventists really think about these concepts, which you helpfully define as well. Before we maybe talk about your articles specifically, you so important in a book like this, you kind of get us on the same page with the word race and the word racism. Would you mind just defining those for us briefly, like you do in the book at least, so that folks kind of understand how you frame these issues?
Yeah, maybe it'd be good to say that a part of the framing of it and the defining of it came not at the beginning, but really toward the end. If I'm correct, Nathan, I think what we realized is that we gave our authors, our contributors, free rein to conceptualize this issue, how they understand it. And then once we saw the diversity amongst it, it became, now, how do we find a working definition that will actually include all of these? And that's a dangerous approach, but I think in a discourse like this, it's the safest approach as we grow together. And I'll tell you why I think that, Nathan, you don't know this, but I meet with a group of Black American intellectual men, laity. And they are a tough group to be with. In fact, Ron Osborne was with me this past Saturday and said, wow, that's a brutal group. and I have relatives in it, right? But once the debate got so heated around the book, and they used the book as the talking place, at first I thought maybe we were too too soft here or too hard there. And I saw the spectrum among that group of men I was with. And toward the end, after we had debated pretty heavy, they said, yeah, I think this actually captures the dynamics. And I thought to myself, this is a discovery. We went and we took a risk. So in some respect, Alex, we were hearing, I think, all right, it's pretty clear our authors believe race is a socially constructed category. And our contributors were reading the popular discourse, engaging with books that were in the in the ethos after George Floyd. So we kind of, I think, recognize that and accept race as a social construct. The other thing we were recognizing is there was that tension in our authors that you also saw in popular authors between racism as a structural problem versus racism as a personal problem.
Sure.
And how it attaches to bigotry and prejudice and these kinds of things. So we tried to capture in our definitions that tension that was also there. And then anti-racism as essentially a kind of programmatic project against this, against it on a structural level, but also on a kind of belief system, personal level. Nathan, am I doing a rough and dirty?
Yeah. I think you're doing well, so I'm happy to listen. I think I'd add one more thing, which I think is a key part of the spark for this project, but even what the project embodies, is that a third thing is racism as a theological problem.
Yeah.
And this was a key thing for, I guess, even my interest in saying we need to do a project on this. I completed a master's program at a college in the US in the mid-20-teens, around, between 2015 and 2017, and spent some time with some key Christian, Black Christian leaders in some intensive classes and some of those kind of things. And at the end of that process, I said, I've been talking about justice for a lot of years in a biblical sense and what that should mean in a practical sense. To me, one of the key things is race is the underlying to a lot of the injustice issues in the world. It's simply this underlying belief that people who are different from us are not as valuable as us, and that's why we allow injustice to persist. And the more different to us and the more obviously different to us, the less we are truly concerned about the injustice and they suffer. And so then I said, well, why do we do that? What other than the practical realities that the, of proximity? And it comes down, I believe, deeply to a 600-year theological issue, stating back, that we often talk about in the context of the doctrine of discovery and the papal decrees that said, that basically divided the world up into the valuable people and the worthless people and the ones that could be used and exploited and disposed of. And then that became the theological basis for racism as we understand it in the modern world. That brings me to two things. One of them is a humility and a sense of confession that Christianity is a key part of the problem. And the other thing is a sense of hope in that we know what to do with theology, and there is nothing, in a sense, more Adventist than a project to rediscover and renew good theology. Yeah. And that the answer to bad theology is better theology, and that is the project that we're called to. And so I see this very much as it's a work of Reformation, it's a work of Adventism in its truest sense, is this work of, working towards, racial healing and a better theology of race in our world.
That's helpful. Yeah, I see Mari ready to go. Jump in.
I want to say something about this as being endorsed too, because I take my group that I meet with as an indicator of what are the issues in the world that people really engage with. And I'll tell you, this group has a member who's 87 years old, an uncle of mine, a college professor, raised Adventist. Now Bart Ehrman has moved him away from the Adventist church. So, you know, he's really engaged in thought, sharp mind and body, all the way to some more conservative Adventist voices. And one of the discussions that Nathan and I had as we were trying to do editorial work was, there were some that wanted to push ideas, and we thought we could go with this, but we'd have to go with a different publisher. And if we went with a different publisher, we probably wouldn't be able to affect the community we care about, the community we've been called in and called to help them in their engagement. And so some of that tension of how broad, how radical, and on the one hand, and how much can we take those who would want to be too safe and push them along and put it together in something we could walk together as a community. And so I think that piece that Nathan talked about theologically and where to kind of give the birth certificate to it helped us kind of measure what we can talk about and as a community and say, yeah, that probably speaks to the heart of our own engagement with the beastly structures and some of the texts that we found important in Adventist tradition.
That's really helpful context. So let's talk about each of your chapters a bit here, just so to give folks a kind of flavor of how you personally are approaching these issues. Let's maybe start with Nathan's chapter. I'll jump back here. Are Adventist silent and committed in activism, getting past our charitable excuses and political objections to doing justice? The title of your chapter, Nathan. And I like this because you're really helping us think beyond the platitudes of charity, which are important, but you're calling us a little bit deeper. What does it mean to do justice? And to me, this felt like there was a nice section of going down a bit of Adventist history on this topic. So you quote from Zach Plantak's The Silent Church, which I think it's interesting to notice 25 years when since it was published coming up this on January. So great to see.
And certainly that was a book I was reacting to, and it's been a kind of very gratifying even to see Dr. Plantak supporting and responding to this book since its release in the last month or so. And that was a formative book when I read it, you know, probably 30 years ago. Or no, you said it was 25
years. You're not that old.
It wasn't 30 years ago. I can't claim that. Maybe it was 20 years ago I read it. But that certainly was a formative book at the time when I read that. And just, you know, what is it? And it almost seems like we've gone backwards even from his quite strong critique 20 years ago. And so what is it that keeps us stuck in that kind of, you know, this kind of objection, but we don't do politics. And of course, the analogy that I've used is that we don't do politics in the same way we don't dance. So we never learn to do it, which means that when we do it poorly.
Yeah.
You know, when you're at your cousin's wedding and you kind of just get sucked into dancing along with everybody else, you've never spent the time to think about it, to learn it. And so you do make a hash of it. And that's what we do with politics. We kind of have this assumption that we don't do politics, which ignores all the ways in which we do, and in all the ways in which our decisions in life and our engagement publicly are actually political, but we don't choose to think about them in that way, and so then we make a mess of them. And that's a real problem because it's poor stewardship. Our call is to use our influence, and particularly those of us who live in, you know, democratic, Western kind of democracy, you know, political systems that actually do have a voice, do have a vote, do have opportunities for influence and to use those influences for good and for the good of others. If we, you know, there's a reason why they call it political science is because it is something that you learn to do well and that we, I think, as faithful stewards should be learning to do and should be even doing training in our church context of not necessarily to you know, and everybody gets nervous about, oh, if we get involved in partisan politics, well, you know, there's a place for that because there is better and worse within partisan politics. That is undeniable. And so we, as people who seek the good of our communities and societies, and we who seek the good of others, should be being good stewards of the opportunities that we have to improve the lot of others. And, you know, it sounds so cliched, but I believe it's actually about what we are about, is to make the world a better place. And, you know, I'm actually still young and hopeful and naive enough to think that that's actually what we should be about. And if our communities, if our countries aren't better places because we are here as people of God, then we've missed a key part of our calling. And so that's what I wrestle with for a few thousand words, and really just make the point that we need to do the work collectively to come up with a better theology of political and social engagement. And we also just need to get our butts out of our pews and maybe do some marching down a street mirror.
Yeah.
Because when we engage with the world around us, we actually will come to appreciate so many other people who are working for good. We'll come to see the opportunities there are for God to be at work in the world, or where God is at work in the world, and we get to be a part of it, and that's pretty exciting.
Well, I join you in the simple idea of making a difference in the world, and I think that Adventism, because of our worldwide reach, which is particular in the Christian community, and our planting of institutions, and to some credit, the sort of evangelistic ethos of getting out and working for the Lord, which I take seriously. Adding up a community engaged, active, political, ethical approach feels like something that makes me want Adventism to expand, and makes me want to be part of that. So I'm glad that you're casting that vision. And I like that you mentioned some folks who have had that. You mentioned Calvin Rock. I read his Church Leadership when I was in academy, and I really appreciated that. You talk about Sam London as well. So there's definitely, in addition to the abolitionist movement that we know about and the Advent movement believers who are connected to that, who helped found Adventism, there's a legacy for us here to draw on, and you both and your authors, I know, are in conversation with that. Mari, I want to talk about you. Great title, Erasing Sin, Adventist Christianity's Catholic Vocation, and that E is in parentheses, and you're giving us some practical theology here, experiential Christianity, helping us think about how we experience or how racism is experienced. I thought maybe I'd have you talk about a little bit of how you're drawing on Adventism's ecumenical movement connections to help us realize that we can draw on this, as you just call it, Catholicity. So can you talk about ways that we can erase sin?
Yeah, so let me just give credit to where credit is due. One of my former students, Samingthong, who is a gentleman from Thailand. He's back in Thailand now. He did his Master of Divinity degree with us at La Sierra University. He's the one who I gave him some long, drawn-out title. He said, Dr. Mori, that won't work. Something like Erasing Sin with a small E. I said, that goes. Let's do it. So I give credit to Samingthong for that.
Nice, nice.
I do want to say, just real quick before I do that, what Nathan's chapter does that's important, it's not only that our evangelism for winning, our personal, you know, personal evangelism or evangelizing persons is important, Adventism needs to start thinking about evangelizing structures and processes. Because that is a part of the Adventist movement. If we take the first Adventist, John the Baptist, as our model for what an Adventist ministry looks like. So John comes and he decides his passage to preach on is, every valley shall be exalted, every mountain and hill made low, the crooked places made straight, the rough places made plain. Then the glory of the Lord will be revealed. And so this idea that we have to wait till things get worse and worse and worse for the glory of the Lord to be revealed is contrary to what an Adventist movement is about. It's actually about changing the structural order to welcome the return of the Christ. And so in that sense, I have appreciated that Adventism in its earliest history was a very ecumenical movement. These were people who were a part of other denominations, and they weren't so much trying to leave their denominations, they were trying to awaken them to the mission to prepare the way of the Lord. And so I don't think we appreciate that as much as we should. Now, I have also made an argument in the book, Seventh-day Adventist Healers, African-American Seventh-day Adventist Healers in a Multicultural Nation, that for me, Adventism in the U.S. started before William Miller in the Black slave and Black Christian movement. That if you read the hymnody of Richard Allen, the founder of the African Methodist, Bishop Richard Allen of the AME Church, his 1801 hymn would be capturing the 1700 musical hymnody of Black Christians. And when you see their hymnody is looking for the return of Christ, that Black Adventists and historians of Adventism need to restory the beginnings of Black of the Adventist movement in the Western Hemisphere. And yes, the Millerite movement really took it to a different key, and that's okay. But even at that new key, guess what we had? We had these Methodists and these Christian connections and these, you know, Episcopalians and Congregationalists all coming together to prepare the way of the Lord. And for me, and this is something that is muted, I would say, in the chapter, and for a purpose it is, but I think I tried to bring in a unique mission for Adventist Christians in light of our hope of a universal salvation. And I make clear it's a hope. It's not a dogma of faith, but it's the hope that God has for everyone, and it's the hope we should have, and the roles that we should think about playing to intercede on behalf of the lost. And I think that that's something Dietrich Bonhoeffer kind of helps us to attend to, and I think Adventist Christianity can really think about that as a mission to erase sin from this world.
Wow. Well, I was thinking about what you were saying there, and that idea of evangelizing institutions made me really interested to explore this idea of like converting organizations and organizational governance, and helping us think about ways that our own institutions can, you know, be, as we maybe rebaptized hospitals and schools. Thank you so much for the work that you put into this book. It's been really great reading your part of it and seeing the plan that you put in place. And as you're thinking about you know, folks reading this, maybe as our final conversation topic, what do you hope is their, what's the takeaway? What do you want them to do when, you know, they've read through each of the chapters, and what kind of Adventist do you hope that they become as they go through this conversion process?
For me, I'll say, and it was there in the introduction. I'll say it this way. Dr. Edmund Jones, he ordained me. He was my pastor in Lancaster, California. And in high school, I came back from Monterey Bay Academy one home leave, and I said, Dr. Jones, can you believe the Pope is doing X, Y, and Z? And he fell out laughing. And I was a little surprised about that. And he said, Maury, the Pope wishes he had the General Conference President's problems. And he said, if all the Adventists in the world joined the Catholic Church, now this was back in the 80s, it would bump it up by 1%. And then he said this to me, and it stuck with me. He said, the larger we grow, the more we will have to deal with diversity. And now we're no longer less than 10 million. We're moving into almost 50. And the question is, are we going to grow up? Are we going to grow not just numerically, but maturationally? And my hope is that the readers of this will expect more of their conference leaders, more of their pastors, a richer engagement in how Adventist voice comes into the public sphere, and that we can not just think about how we pastor one-to-one, a pastor to someone in crisis, or one-to-group, the pastor to his or her congregation, but how do we pastor group-to-group? How does the whole denomination pastor the world?
Hmm.
And that we can take on that bolder mission.
Yeah, beautiful. Mm-hmm. And Nathan?
You mentioned earlier the prophets, the prophetic voices we put on the epigraph page of James Baldwin and James Cone and Isaiah. And to me, that kind of sums it up, particularly the quote from James Cone to me is quite, you know, it's one of those lines that has just changed the way I think.
And it's simply basically,
yeah, do that.
If God had chosen us as his holy nation, let me start that over. If God had chosen as his holy nation the Egyptian slave masters instead of the Israelite slaves, a completely different kind of God would have been revealed.
Yeah. To me, that's one of those transformative thoughts that so, you know, kind of makes sense but needs somebody to say it. And just that this understanding actually changes our perception of God. It changes how we understand God, how we see God in the world, mm-hmm. how we see God's purposes in the world, and how we see our role within it. And, you know, so this is a God-forming project, you know, in our understanding and conceptions of God. And then the quote from Isaiah brings that back to the very practical, where it is learn to do justice. You know, seek good, learn to do justice in Isaiah 1:17. Just that this is something we need to learn to practice in the best sense of the word, like when you're practicing piano as a young person, or not as some of us, the more you practice it, the better you get at it. And so when we practice our faith, the better we get at it. And we get better at it by doing it over and over again, and by doing it in practical ways, and by putting in effort to it and being intentional about learning about, you know, learning how to be politically engaged, learning how to do that in ways that are effective and that matter and make a difference. And so we have that biblical mandate, you know, a transformed understanding of God, and then a biblical mandate to be practical and to learn how to live out our faith more effectively in the world.
Hmm. Well, beautifully stated by both of you. Thank you so much for this book, and I'm looking forward to seeing more of the authors from this book in various Adventist media, and giving folks an opportunity to learn about the not just the individual ideas, but the larger project to, as you say here, how Adventist faith can respond to race and racism. I like that idea, Adventist really engaging with contemporary issues. So thank you so much.
Yes, I knew Sister White.
We will will not fear.